Chubb did not like murder. He had become a policeman because he believed in order, and he considered the county of Somerset, with its neat villages, hedgerows, and ancient fields, to be one of the most ordered and civilized parts of the country, if not the world. Murder changed everything. It broke the gentle rhythm of life. It turned neighbor against neighbor. Suddenly, nobody was to be trusted, and doors, which were usually left open at night, were locked. Murder was an act of vandalism, a brick thrown at a picture window, and somehow it was his job to put together the pieces. Sitting in his office in the Orange Grove police station in Bath, he reflected on his current investigation. This business with Sir Magnus Pye had not got off to an inauspicious start. It was one thing to be stabbed in your own home, but to be decapitated with a medieval sword in the middle of the night was quite simply outrageous. Saxby-on-Avon was such a quiet place. Yes, there had been that business with the cleaner, the woman who had tripped up and fallen down the stairs, but this was something else again. Could it really be true that one of the villagers, living in a Georgian house, perhaps, going to church and playing for the local cricket team, mowing their lawn on Sunday mornings and selling homemade marmalade at the village fete, was a homicidal maniac? The answer was yes, quite possibly. And their identity might well be provided by the book sitting on the desk in front of him now. He had found nothing in Sir Magnus's safe of any interest, and it had looked as if the lodge house was going to be a waste of time too. And then an eagle-eyed constable, young Winterbrook, had made his discovery amongst the cookery books in Mary Blakiston's kitchen. He was going to go far, that boy. He just needed to show a more serious attitude and a bit more ambition, and he'd be an inspector in no time. Had she hidden it there deliberately? Had she been afraid of someone coming into the house, her son, perhaps, or Sir Magnus himself? Certainly it wasn't something she'd want to leave lying around, containing, as it did, malicious observations on just about everyone in the village. There was Mr. Turnstone, the butcher, who deliberately shortchanged his customers. Geoffrey Weaver, the undertaker, who was apparently cruel to his dog. Edgar Renard, the retired doctor who took bribes. Miss Dotterell, the village shop, who drank. Nobody seemed to have escaped her attention. It had already taken him 2 whole days to go through it all, and by the end of that time he felt almost sullied. He remembered seeing Mary Blakiston, glassy-eyed at the bottom of the stairs at Pye Hall, already cold and stiff. At the time, he had felt pity for her. Now he wondered what had motivated her as she shuffled round the village, permanently suspicious, permanently on the lookout for trouble. Couldn't she just once have found something good? Her handwriting managed to be cramped and spidery, yet very neat, as if she were some sort of accountant of evil. Yes, Punt would like that one. It was exactly the sort of thing he might say. Each entry was dated. This volume covered 3.5 years, and Chubb had already sent Winterbrook back to the house to see if he could find any earlier editions. Not that he didn't have plenty enough to be getting on with. Mrs. Blakiston had 2 or 3 special favourites who turned up on page after page. Curiously, despite the acrimony between them, her son Robert wasn't one of them, although Josie, or Joy, had become an object of disdain the moment she had been introduced. She really hated the groundsman, Brent. His name kept on appearing. He was rude, he was lazy, he arrived late, he pilfered, he spied on the Boy Scouts when they were camping in Dingle Dell, he drank, he told lies, he never washed. It seemed that she had shared her thoughts with Sir Magnus Pye. At least, that was what she suggested in one of her last entries. The 14th of July. Finally some sense. Sir M. has asked Brent to leave his employ. It happened last night up at the hall. Brent not at all happy, scowling this morning and deliberately tramped through a bed of aquilegia. Saw him with my own eyes and mentioned it to dear Sir M., who told me that it didn't matter as he was going anyway. And about time, too. I've told him often enough. Sir M didn't mention reason, but there could be so many. Plenty of young men looking for work in the area, I said, and a good thing too. Suggested advertisement in the Lady, but Sir M prefers agency as more discreet. More expensive too. Not that it would matter to him, I suppose. A day later, she had been dead. And a week after that, Sir M had died too. A coincidence? Surely the two of them hadn't been killed on account of a trampled bunch of flowers. Chubb had marked 7 more entries which he thought might somehow relate to the case. All but one of them were recent, and so more likely to be relevant to the murder of Sir Magnus. Once again he flicked through them, reading them in the order that seemed to make most sense. The 13th of July. An interesting talk with Dr. Redwing. How many thieves can there be in one village? This is very serious. A drug has been stolen from her surgery. She wrote down the name for me. Physostigmine. She says a large dose could quite possibly be fatal. I told her she should go to the police, but of course she doesn't want to because she thinks she'll be blamed. I like Dr. R., but I do sometimes question her judgment, having that girl working there, for example. And she isn't quite as careful as she thinks. I've been into the surgery lots of times, and I could have just walked in and helped myself. When did it happen? I think Dr. R. is wrong. Not the day, she says, but the day before. I saw her coming out, and I knew something was wrong. I saw it in her face, and the way she was holding her handbag. The surgery was empty. Absolutely no sign of the girl when I went in. She'd definitely been there alone, and the medicine cupboard was left open, so could easily have taken contents. What would she want it for? Pop it in her brother's tea? Maybe revenge. Can't be happy about being number 2. But I have to be careful. I can't make accusations. Something to think about. The 9th of July. Arthur Reeve, too upset to talk. His medal collection gone. A horrible thing to happen. The thief broke in through the kitchen window, cut himself on glass. You'd have thought that would be a big enough clue, but the police weren't interested, of course. They said it must have been children, but I don't think so. The thieves knew exactly what they wanted. The Greek medal alone was worth a tidy sum. Typical, how nobody cares anymore. I went in and had a cup of tea with him. Did wonder if our friend might be involved, but didn't say anything. I'll have a look in and see, but careful. Leopards and spots. Terrible to have someone like this living in the village. And dangerous. I really should have told Sir Magnus. Hilda Reeve not even interested. Not helping her husband. Says she can't see what all the fuss is about. Stupid woman. Can't think why he married her. The 11th of July. Visited Whitehead in his shop while his wife was out and told him what I knew. Of course he denied everything. Well, he would, wouldn't he? I showed him the piece I'd found in the newspaper, and he said that was all behind him. Actually accused me of trying to make trouble for him. Oh, no, I told him. You're the one making trouble here. He said he'd never been anywhere near Arthur's home. But his shop is stuffed with all manner of bits and pieces, and you have to wonder where he gets it from. He dared me to go public. He said he'd sue me. We'll see. Chubb might have ignored both these entries. Arthur Reeve and his wife were an elderly couple and had once run the Queen's Arms. It would be hard to imagine anyone less likely to be involved in Sir Magnus's death. And how could the theft of his medals have any possible relevance? The meeting with Whitehead had made no sense. But tucked into the back of the diary, he had found a newspaper clipping, faded and brittle, and it had forced him to think again. Gangland Fence released from jail. He achieved brief notoriety as part of the Mansion Gang, a network of professional burglars who targeted mansion blocks in Kensington and Chelsea. Arrested for receiving stolen goods, John Whitehead was released from Pentonville Prison after serving just 4 years of a 7-year sentence. Mr. Whitehead, who is married, is believed to have left London. There was no picture, but Chubb had already checked that there was indeed a Johnny Whitehead living with his wife in the village, and that it was the same Johnny Whitehead who had once been arrested in London. There had been plenty of organized criminals operating in the city during and after the war, and the Mansion Gang had been notorious. Whitehead had been their fence, and now he ran an antique store, no less. He looked again at the two words in Mary Blakiston's handwriting. And dangerous? The question mark was certainly apposite. If Whitehead was an ex-criminal and she had tried to expose him, could he have been responsible for her death? If she had talked about him to Sir Magnus, might he have been forced to strike again? Chubb carefully set the newspaper article aside and went back to the diary. The 7th of July. Shocking. I always knew there was something about Reverend Osborne and his wife, but this, I wish old Montague had stayed. Really, really, don't know what to say or do. Nothing, I suppose. Who would believe me? Dreadful. The 6th of July. Lady Pye back from London, again. All these trips she makes, everyone knows what's going on, but nobody will say anything. I suppose these are the times we live in. I feel sorry for Sir Magnus, such a good man, always so kind to me. Does he know? Should I say something? The last entry that Chubb had selected had been written almost 4 months earlier. Mary Blakiston had written several entries about Joy Sanderling, but this one followed their first meeting. She had written it in black ink, using a much thicker nib. The letters were splattered onto the page, and Chubb could almost feel the anger and disgust as her pen travelled across the paper. Mary had always been a fairly impartial observer, which is to say she had been equally spiteful and unpleasant about everyone she encountered, but she seemed to have a special reserve for Joy. The 15th of March. Tea with little Miss Sanderling. She says her name is Josie, but call me Joy. I will not call her that. There is no joy in this marriage. Why can't she understand? I will not let it happen. 12 years ago, I lost my first son. I will not allow her to take Robert away from me. I gave her tea and biscuits, and she just sat there with that stupid smile on her face, so young, so ignorant. She prattled on about her parents and her family. She has a brother with Down syndrome. Why did she have to tell me that? Robert just sat there saying nothing, and all the time I was thinking about this awful sickness infecting her family, and how much I wanted her to leave. I should have told her then and there. But she's obviously the sort of girl who won't listen to the likes of me. I will talk to Robert later. I won't have it. I really won't. Why did this stupid girl have to come to Saxby? For the first time, Chubb felt a real dislike for Mary Blakiston, almost a sense that she had deserved to die. He would never actually say that about anyone, but he had to admit that the whole diary was pure poison, and this entry was unforgivable. It was the reference to Down's syndrome that most upset him. Mary described it as an awful sickness. It wasn't. It was a condition, not an illness. What sort of woman could see it as a threat to her own bloodline? Had she really pulled up the drawbridge on her son's marriage simply to protect future grandchildren from some sort of contamination? It beggared belief. Part of him hoped that this would turn out to be the only volume of Mary Blakiston's memoirs. He dreaded having to wade through any more pages of misery and resentment. Didn't she have anything good to say about anyone? But at the same time, he knew he had stumbled on too valuable a resource to ignore. He would have to show it all to Atticus Punt. He was glad that the detective had turned up in Somerset. The two of them had worked together on that case in Marlborough, a headmaster who had been killed during the performance of a play. This business had many of the same hallmarks, a tangle of suspects and different motives, and not one but two deaths that might or might not be related. In the privacy of his own home, Chubb would admit the truth, which was that he couldn't make head or tail of it. Punt had a way of seeing things differently. Maybe it was in his nature. Chubb couldn't help but smile. All his life, he'd been brought up to think of the Germans as his enemy. It was strange having one on his side. It was equally strange that Joyce Sanderling had actually brought him here. It had already occurred to Chubb that she and her fiancé, Robert Blakiston, had the most compelling reason for wanting to see Mary Blakiston dead. They were young and in love, and she had wanted to stop the wedding for the very worst and most hateful of reasons. For a brief moment, he himself had shared their feelings. But if they had planned to kill her, why would they have tried to get Punt involved? Could it have been an elaborate smokescreen? Turning these thoughts over in his mind, Raymond Chubb lit a cigarette and went through the pages again. Chapter 6. In his masterwork, The Landscape of Criminal Investigation, Atticus Punt had written, "One can think of the truth as eine Vertiefung, a sort of deep valley, which may not be visible from a distance, but which will come upon you quite suddenly. There are many ways to arrive there. A line of questioning that turns out to be irrelevant still has the power to bring you nearer to your goal. There are no wasted journeys in the detection of a crime." In other words, it did not matter that he had not yet seen Mary Blakiston's diary and had no idea of its contents. Although he and Inspector Chubb were taking two very different approaches, it was inevitable that eventually they would meet. After they had left the lodge house, he and Fraser had walked the short distance to the vicarage, following the road rather than using the shortcut through Dingle Dell, enjoying the warmth of the afternoon. Fraser had rather taken to Saxby-on-Avon and was a little puzzled that the detective seemed so immune to its charms. Indeed, it struck him that Punt hadn't been quite himself since they had left London, lapsing into long silences, lost in his thoughts. The two of them were now sitting in the living room where Henrietta had brought them tea and homemade biscuits. It was a bright, cheerful room with dried flowers in the fireplace and French windows that looked out onto a well-kept garden with woodland beyond. There was an upright piano, several shelves of books, door curtains that would be drawn in the winter. The furniture was comfortable. None of it matched. Robin and Henrietta Osborne were sitting next to each other on a sofa and could not have looked more awkward or, frankly, more guilty. Punt had barely started his interrogation, but they were already defensive, clearly dreading what might come next. Fraser understood what they were going through. He had seen it before. You could be completely blameless and respectable, but the moment you talked to the detective, you became a suspect, and nothing you said could be taken at face value. It was all part of the game, and it seemed to him that the Osbornes weren't playing it too well. "On the night that Sir Magnus Pye was murdered, Mrs. Osborne, you left your home. This would have been about 8:15. Punt waited for her to deny this, and when she didn't, added, "Why?
May I ask who told you that?"
Henrietta countered. Punt shrugged. "Believe me, it is of no importance, Mrs. Osborne. It is my task to establish where everyone was at the time of the death, to piece together the jigsaw, you might say. I ask questions and I receive answers. That is all."
"It's just that I don't like the idea of being spied on. That's the trouble with living in a village. Everyone is always looking at you."
The vicar patted her gently on the hand, and she continued.
"Yes, I was out looking for my husband at about that time. The thing is..." She hesitated. "We were both rather upset about some news we'd just heard, and he'd gone off on his own. When it was getting dark and he hadn't come home, I began to wonder where he was."
"And where, in fact, were you, Mr. Osborne?"
"I went to the church. Whenever I need to sort myself out, that's where I go. I'm sure you understand."
"Did you walk, or did you go on your bicycle?"
"The way you ask that question, Mr. Punt, I suspect you already know the answer. I took the bike. What time did you return home? I suppose it would have been about 9:30. Punt frowned. According to Brent, he had heard the vicar cycle up past the ferryman about 30 minutes after he had arrived. That would have been about 9:00 or 9:15. There was a discrepancy, at least 15 minutes missing. You are sure of that time? He asked. I'm absolutely sure, Henrietta cut in. I've already told you. I was concerned. I certainly had one eye on the clock, and it was exactly 9:30 when my husband arrived. I had kept his dinner for him, and I sat with him while he ate it. Punt did not pursue the matter. There were three possibilities. The first, and most obvious, was that the Osbornes were lying. Certainly the woman seemed nervous, as if she were trying to protect her husband. The second was that Brent had been mistaken, although he had seemed surprisingly reliable. And the third, I would imagine that it was the announcement of the new housing development that had upset you, he said. Exactly. Osborne pointed at the window, at the view beyond. That's where it's going to be, right there, at the end of our garden. Well, of course, this house isn't ours. It belongs to the church, and my wife and I won't be here forever. But it seems such a destructive thing to do, so unnecessary. It may never happen, Fraser said, what with Sir Magnus being dead and all that. Well, I'm not going to celebrate any person's death. That would be quite wrong. But I will admit to you that when I heard the news, I did entertain precisely that thought. It was wrong of me. I shouldn't allow my personal feelings to poison my judgment. You should take a look at Dingle Dell, Henrietta cut in. If you haven't walked there, you won't understand why it means so much to us. Would you like me to show you? I would like that very much, Punt replied. They had finished the tea. Fraser quietly helped himself to another biscuit, and they all went out through the French windows. The vicarage garden extended for about 20 yards, sloping downhill with flower beds on each side of a lawn that became wilder and more unkempt the further they went from the house. It had been deliberately landscaped that way. There was no fence or barrier between the Osbornes' property and the wood beyond, making it impossible to say where one ended and the other began. Quite suddenly, they were in Dingle Dell. The trees, oak, ash, and witch elm, closed in on them without warning, surrounding them and cutting off the world outside. It was a lovely place. The late afternoon sun, slanting through the leaves and branches, had become a soft green, and there were butterflies dancing in the beams. Purple hair streak, Henrietta muttered. The ground was soft underfoot. Grass and patches of moss with clumps of flowers. There was something curious about the wood. It wasn't a wood at all. It was a dell, much smaller. And yet, now they were in it, there seemed to be no edges, no obvious way out. Everything was very hushed. Although a few birds were flitting around the trees, they did so without making any sound. Only the drone of a bumblebee disturbed the silence, and it was gone as quickly as it had come. Some of these trees have been here for 200 or 300 years, Osborne said. He looked around him. You know that Sir Magnus found his treasure trove here, Roman coins and jewellery, probably buried to keep them safe. Every time we walk here, it's different. Wonderful toadstools later in the year, all sorts of different insects, if you're into that sort of thing. They came to a clump of wild garlic, the white flowers bursting out like stars, and then beyond it, another plant, this one a tangle of spiky leaves that sprawled across the path. Atropa belladonna, Punt said. Deadly nightshade. I understand, Mrs. Osborne, that you unfortunately stepped on a specimen and poisoned yourself. Yes, it was very stupid of me, and unlucky too. It somehow cut my foot. She laughed nervously. I can't imagine what possessed me to come out without my shoes. I suppose I like the feeling of the moss on the soles of my feet. Anyway, I certainly learned my lesson. I'll steer clear of it from now on. Do you want to go on? Osborne asked. Pye Hall is just on the other side.
Yes, it would be interesting to see it again, Punt replied.
There was no actual path. They continued through the green haze, arriving at the far edge of the wood as unexpectedly as they had entered it. Suddenly the trees parted, and there, in front of them, was the lake, still and black, with the lawn easing its way down towards it from Pye Hall. Freddy Pye was outside, kicking a football around, and Brent was kneeling in front of a flower bed with a pair of secateurs. Neither of them had noticed the little party as they had arrived. From where they were standing, the lodge house was completely out of sight, hidden by its own woodland screen.
Well, here we are, Osborne said.
He put his arm around his wife, then thought better of it and let it drop.
Pye Hall is quite splendid, really.
It was a nunnery at one stage. It's been in the same family for centuries. At least that's one thing they can't do, knock it down.
It is a house that has seen a great deal of death, Punt remarked.
Yes, I suppose that's true of many country houses, but not quite so recently. You were away when Mary Blakiston died.
I already told you that when we met outside the church.
You said you were in Devon.
That's right.
Where, exactly?
The vicar seemed nonplussed. He turned his head away, and his wife broke in angrily.
Why are you asking us these questions, Mr. Punt? Do you really think that Robin and I made it up about being away? Do you think we sneaked back and pushed poor Mrs. Blakiston down the stairs? What possible reason could we have? And I suppose we lopped off Sir Magnus's head to save Dingle Dell, even though it may not make a jot of difference, his beastly son might go ahead with it anyway.
Atticus Punt spread his hands and sighed. Mrs. Osborne, you do not understand the demands of police and detective work. Of course I do not believe the things that you suggest, and it gives me no pleasure to ask you these questions, but everything must be in its place. Every statement must be verified, every movement examined. It may be that you do not wish to tell me where you were. Eventually, you will have to tell the inspector. I am sorry if you consider it an intrusion.
Robin Osborne glanced at his wife, who replied, "Of course we don't mind telling you. It's just not very nice being treated as suspects. If you talk to the manager of the Shepley Court Hotel, he'll tell you we were there all week. It's near Dartmouth."
"Thank you."
They turned and walked back through Dingle Dell, Punt and Robin Osborne in front, Henrietta and James Fraser behind.
"It was, of course, you who officiated at the funeral of Mrs. Blakiston," Punt said.
"That's right. It was lucky we were back in time, although I suppose I could always have cut my holiday short."
"I wonder if you remarked upon a person who was unknown to the village. He was standing on his own, I believe, separate from the other mourners. I have been told that he was wearing an old-fashioned hat."
Robin Osborne considered.
"There was someone there wearing a fedora, I think," he said. "They left quite abruptly, as I recall. But I'm afraid I can't tell you very much more than that. As you can imagine, I had my mind on other things. He certainly didn't come for drinks at the Queen's Arms."
"Did you happen to notice Robert Blakiston during the service? I would be interested to know your impressions of how he behaved."
"Robert Blakiston?"
They had reached the clump of belladonna, and Osborne was careful to avoid it.
"I wonder why you're asking about him," he went on. "If you must know, I feel rather sorry for him. I heard about the argument he had with his mother. The village was full of gossip after she died. I wasn't having any of it. I think people can be quite cruel, or thoughtless anyway. Often it's the same thing. I can't say I know Robert very well. He hasn't had an easy life, but he's found himself a young lady now, and I couldn't be more pleased for him. Miss Sanderling works at the doctor's surgery, and I'm sure she'll help him settle down. The two of them have asked me to marry them at St. Botolph's.
I'm very much looking forward to it. He paused, then went on. He and his mother quarrelled. That's common knowledge. But I was observing him throughout the service. He and Josie were standing quite close to me, and I would have said he was genuinely grieving. When I reached the last paragraph of my address, he started crying and covered his eyes to hide the tears, and Josie had to take his arm. It's hard for a boy to lose his mother, no matter what the feelings between them, and I'm sure he bitterly regretted what he had said. Speak in haste, repent at leisure, as the old saying goes. What was your opinion of Mary Blakiston? Osborne didn't answer at once. He continued walking until they had emerged once again in the vicarage garden. She was very much part of the village. She'll be missed, was all he said. I would be interested to see the funeral address, Punt said. Would you by any chance have a copy? Really? The vicar's eyes brightened. He had put a lot of work into the speech. As a matter of fact, I did hang on to it. I've got it inside. Are you coming back in? Never mind. I'll get it for you. He hurried in through the French windows. Punt turned in time to see Fraser emerge from Dingle Dell with the vicar's wife, the light slanting down behind them. It was true, he thought. The wood was a very special place, somewhere worth protecting. But at what price? Chapter 7. That afternoon, there was another death. Dr. Redwing had driven back to Ashton House, and this time her husband had accompanied her. The call from the matron had come that afternoon, and although she had said nothing specific, there could be no mistaking the tone of her voice. It might be best if you were here. I do think you should come. Dr. Redwing had made similar calls herself. Old Edgar Renard had not, after all, recovered from the slight fall he had taken the week before. On the contrary, it seemed to have jolted or broken something, and since then he had begun a rapid slide. He had barely been awake since his daughter's last visit. He had eaten nothing, taken only a few sips of water. The life was visibly draining out of him. Arthur and Amelia were sitting on the uncomfortable furniture in the overly bright room, watching the rise and fall of the old man's chest beneath the blankets. They both knew what the other was thinking, but didn't like to put it into words. How long would they have to sit here? At what time would it be reasonable to call it a day and go back home? Would they blame themselves if they weren't there at the end? In the end, would it make any difference? You can go if you like, Amelia said eventually.
No, I'll stay with you.
Are you sure?
Yes, of course.
He thought for a moment. Would you like a coffee?
That would be nice.
It was impossible to have any sort of conversation in a room with a dying man. Arthur Redwing got to his feet and shuffled off to the kitchenette at the end of the corridor. Amelia was left on her own. And that was when Edgar Renard opened his eyes, quite unexpectedly, as if he had merely nodded off in front of the television. He saw her at once, and showed not the least surprise. Perhaps in his mind she had never gone away, for he returned almost at once to the subject he had raised the last time they were together.
"Did you tell him?"
he asked.
"Did I tell who, Papa?"
She wondered whether she ought to call Arthur back, but she was afraid of raising her voice or doing anything that might disturb the dying man.
"It's not fair. I have to tell them. They have to know."
"Papa, do you want me to call the nurse?"
"No."
He was suddenly angry, as if he knew that there were only minutes left, that there was no time for delay. At the same moment, a sort of clarity came into his eyes. Later on, Dr. Redwing would say that he had been given this one last gift at the end of his life. The dementia had finally retreated, leaving him in control.
"I was there when the children were born," he said.
His voice was younger, stronger.
I delivered them at Pye Hall. Lady Cynthia Pye, a beautiful woman, daughter of an earl. But she wasn't strong, not built to give birth to twins. I was afraid I might lose her. In the end, it all went well. Two children born 12 minutes apart, a boy and a girl, both healthy. But afterwards, before anyone knew what had happened, Sir Merrill Pye came to see me. Sir Merrill. He wasn't a good man. Everyone was afraid of him, and he wasn't happy. Because, you see, the girl had come first. The estate was entailed on the first-born child. It was unusual, but that's how it was. Not the eldest male child, but he wanted it to be the boy. He'd got the house from his father, who'd got it from his father before him. It had always been boys, do you understand? He hated the idea of the whole estate passing to a girl, and so he made me... He told me the boy came first. Emilia looked at her father, with his head resting on the pillow, his white hair forming a halo around him, his eyes bright with the effort of explaining.
"Papa, what did you do?" she asked.
"What do you think I did? I told a lie. He was a bit of a bully, Sir Merrill. He could have made my life a misery. And at the time I told myself, what did it matter? After all, they were just two babies. They didn't know anything, and they would both grow up in the house together. It wasn't as if I was hurting anyone. That was what I thought." A tear trickled out of the corner of his eye and made its way down the side of his face. So I filled in the form the way he wanted it. 3:48 a.m., a boy, and 4 a.m., a girl. That's what I wrote.
"Oh, Papa."
"It was wrong of me. I see that now. Magnus got everything and Clarissa got nothing. And I often thought that I should tell her, tell both of them the truth. But what good would it do? Nobody would believe me. Sir Merrill is long gone and Lady Cynthia... They're all forgotten. But it's haunted me. It's always haunted me. What I wrote was a lie. A boy. I said it was a boy."
By the time Arthur Redwing returned with the coffees, Dr. Renard had breathed his last. He found his wife sitting in shock and assumed, obviously, that it was due to the loss. He stayed with her while the matron was called and the necessary arrangements made. Dr. Renard had taken out funeral insurance with the well-known company of Lanner and Crane, and they would be informed first thing in the morning. It was too late now. In the meantime, he would be transferred to a small chapel within Ashton House that was reserved for such occasions. He was going to be buried in the cemetery at King's Abbot, close to the house where he had lived. He had made that decision when he retired. It was only as they were driving home that Amelia Redwing repeated what her father had told her. Arthur, behind the wheel, was shocked. "Good God," he exclaimed. "Are you sure he knew what he was saying?" "It was extraordinary. He was completely lucid. Just for the 5 minutes he were gone." "I'm sorry, dear. You should have called me."
"It doesn't matter. I just wish you'd been there to hear it."
"I could have been a witness."
Dr. Redwing hadn't considered that, but now she nodded.
"Yes."
"What are you going to do?"
Dr. Redwing didn't answer. She watched the Bath Valley slipping by, cows dotted here and there, grazing on the other side of the railway line. The summer sun hadn't set, but the light was soft, the shadows folding themselves into the sides of the hills.
"I don't know," she said at length. "In a way, I wish he hadn't told me. It was his guilty secret, and now it's mine."
She sighed.
I suppose I'm going to have to tell someone. I'm not sure it'll make any difference. Even if you had been there, there isn't any proof.
Maybe you should tell that detective.
Mr. Punt.
She was annoyed with herself. It had never occurred to her that there might be a connection, but of course she had to pass on what she knew. Sir Magnus Pye, the beneficiary of a huge estate, had been violently murdered, and now it turned out that the estate had never been his in the first place. Could that be the reason why he had been killed?
Yes, she said. I suppose I had better let him know.
They drove on in silence.
Then her husband said, And what about Clarissa Pye? Will you tell her?
Do you think I should?
I don't know. I really don't. They reached the village, and as they drove past the fire station and then the Queen's Arms with the church just behind it, they were unaware that they were both having the same thought. What if Clarissa had already known? Chapter 8. At exactly that moment, inside the Queen's Arms, James Fraser was carrying a tray with 5 drinks to a quiet table in the far corner. There were 3 pints of beer, for himself, for Robert Blakiston, and for Inspector Chubb, a Dubonnet and bitter lemon for Joy Sanderling, and a small sherry for Atticus Punt. He would have liked to have added a couple of bags of crisps, but something told him that they would be inappropriate. As he sat down, he examined the man who had brought them there. Robert Blakiston, who had lost both a mother and a mentor in the space of 2 weeks, had come straight from work. He had changed out of his overalls and put on a jacket, but his hands were still covered with grease and oil. Fraser wondered if it would ever come off. He was a strange-looking young man, not unattractive, but almost like a bad drawing of himself, with his badly cut hair, his overpronounced cheekbones, his pale skin. He was sitting next to Joy, quite possibly holding her hand under the table. His eyes were haunted. It was obvious that he would have preferred to be anywhere but here.
"You don't need to worry, Rob," Joy was saying. "Mr. Punt only wants to help."
"Like he helped you when you went to London?"
Robert was having none of it. "This village won't let us alone.
First, they said it was me who killed my own mother. Not that I would ever have laid a finger on her, you know that. And as if that wasn't enough for them, then they start their whispering about Sir Magnus."
He turned to Atticus. "Is that why you're here, Mr. Pound? Is it because you suspect me?"
"Did you have a reason to wish Sir Magnus harm?" Punt asked.
"No. He wasn't an easy man, I'll give you that. But he was always very good to me. I wouldn't have a job if it weren't for him."
"I must ask you many things about your life, Robert," Punt went on. "It is not because you are under suspicion any more than anyone else in this village. But both deaths occurred at Pye Hall, and it is true to say that you have a close association with that place."
"I didn't choose it that way."
"Of course not. But you can perhaps tell us a great deal about its history and about the people who lived there."
Robert's one visible hand curled round his beer. He looked up at Punt defiantly. "You're not a policeman," he said. "Why should I have to tell you anything?"
"I'm a policeman," Chop cut in. He had been about to light a cigarette and stopped with the match inches away from his face. "And Mr. Punt is working with me. You should mind your manners, young man. If you don't want to cooperate, we'll see what a night behind bars will do to change your mind. It won't be the first time you've seen the inside of a jail, I understand."
He lit the cigarette and blew out the match. Joy put a hand on her fiancé's arm.
"Please, Robert."
He shrugged her off. "I've got nothing to hide. You can ask me what you want."
"Then let us begin at the very beginning," Punt suggested. "If it does not distress you, perhaps you can describe for us your childhood at Pye Hall?"
"It doesn't distress me, although I was never very happy there," Robert answered. "It's not very nice when your mother cares more about her employer than your own father. But that's how it was, almost from the day we moved into the lodge house. Sir Magnus this, Sir Magnus that. She was all over him, even though she was never more than his skivvy. My dad wasn't happy about it either. It was never easy for him living in someone else's house, in someone else's grounds. But they stuck with it for a time. My dad wasn't getting much work before the war. It was somewhere to live, a regular income. So he put up with it. I was 12 years old when we moved in. We'd been living up at Shepherd's Farm, which was my granddad's place. It was pretty run down, but we liked it there, left to our own devices. Me and Tom had been born in Saxby-on-Avon, and we always lived here. As far as I was concerned, there was nowhere else in the world. Sir Magnus needed someone to look after the place when the old housekeeper left, and my mum was already doing jobs around the village, so it was an obvious choice, really. The first year or so was okay. The lodge house wasn't such a bad place, and we had plenty of room after Shepherd's Farm. We all had our own rooms, which was nice. Mum and Dad at the end of the corridor. I used to boast about it at school, having such a grand address, although the other kids just teased me about it. How well did you and your brother get on? We had fights, like all little boys, but we were also very close. We used to chase each other all over the estate. We were pirates, treasure hunters, soldiers, spies. Tom used to make up all the games. He was younger than me, but he was a lot smarter, too. He used to tap out this code on the wall to me at night. He'd made it up himself. I didn't understand a word of it, but I'd hear him tapping it out when we were meant to be asleep. He half smiled at the memory, and just for a moment, some of the tension went out of his face. You had a dog, I believe. Its name was Bella. At once the frown was back. Fraser remembered the collar that they had found in the bedroom of the lodge house, but he wondered what relevance it could have. Bella was Tom's dog, Robert said. My dad got it for him around the time we left Shepherd's Farm. He glanced at Joy, as if unsure whether to continue. But after we moved in, it didn't end well. What happened? We never really found out, but I'll tell you this. Sir Magnus didn't want him on his land. That much was clear. He said that Bella chased the sheep. He said right away he wanted us to get rid of it, but Tom really loved that dog, so Dad said no. Anyway, one day it disappeared. We looked everywhere for it, but it was just gone. And then, about 2 weeks later, we found it in Dingle Dell. He paused and looked down. Someone had cut its throat. Tom always said it was Brent, but if it was, he was only acting on Sir Magnus's orders. There was a long silence. When Punt spoke again, his voice was low. I must ask you now about another death, he said. I am sure it will be painful to you, but you understand. You're talking about Tom. Yes. Robert nodded. When the war began, my dad went over to Boscombe Down, where he worked on the plains, and he'd often stay there the whole week, so we only saw him now and then. Maybe if he'd been there, maybe if he'd looked out for us more, it would never have happened. That's what my mum always said. She blamed him for not being there. Can you tell me what occurred? I'll never forget it, Mr. Pound. Not as long as I live. At the time, I thought it was my fault. That was what a lot of people said, and maybe it was what my dad believed. He never talked to me about it. He hardly ever spoke to me again, and I haven't seen him now in years. Well, maybe he's got a point. Tom was 2 years younger than me, and I was meant to be looking after him, but I left him on his own. And the next thing I know, they're pulling him out of the lake, and he's drowned. He was only 12 years old. It wasn't your fault, Robert, Joy said. She put her arm around him, holding him tightly. It was an accident. You weren't even there. I was the one who led him out into the garden. I left him on his own. He gazed at Punt, with eyes that were suddenly bright with tears. It was the summer, a day like today.
We were on a treasure hunt. We were always looking for bits and pieces, silver and gold. We knew how Sir Magnus had found a whole load of the stuff in Dingle Dell. Buried treasure. It was the sort of thing that every boy dreamed about. We'd read stories in the Magnet and the Hotspur, and then we'd try to make them come real. Sir Magnus used to encourage us, too. He'd actually set us challenges. So maybe he was partly to blame for what happened. I don't know. It's always about blame, isn't it? These things happen, and you have to find some way to make them make sense. Tom drowned in the lake. To this day, we don't know how it happened. He was fully dressed, so it wasn't as if he'd gone for a swim. Maybe he fell, maybe he hit his head. Brent was the one who found him and got him out. I heard him shouting, and I came running back across the lawn. I helped to get him on dry land, and I tried to resuscitate him the way they showed us at school. But there was nothing I could do. By the time Mum came down and found us, it was too late. Neville Brent was already working there, Chubb asked. He must have been in his teens himself. Yes, he was very young, but he used to help his father. In fact, he took over the job when his dad died. It must have been a great shock for you and very upsetting to see your brother in this way, Punt said. I threw myself into the water. I grabbed hold of him. I was screaming and I was crying and even now I can't bring myself to look at that damned place. I never wanted to stay in the lodge house, and if I had my way, I'd get out of Saxby-on-Avon altogether, and now, what with everything that's happened, maybe I will. Anyway, my dad came back that night. He shouted at my mother. He shouted at me. He never gave us any support. All we got from him was anger. And a year later, he left us. He said the marriage was over. We never saw him again. How did your mother respond to what had happened? She still stayed working for Sir Magnus. That's the first thing. She would never have thought of leaving him, no matter what. That's how much she looked up to him. She'd walk past that lake every day on her way to work. She told me that she never looked, that she kept her head the other way, but I don't know how she did it. She was still caring for you? She was trying to, Mr. Pound. I suppose I might as well admit it, although I never thanked her for it. Nothing was ever easy after Tom died. Things went wrong at school. The other children could be so bloody cruel, and she was afraid for me. She never let me out of the house. Sometimes I felt like a prisoner. She was always watching me. She was terrified something was going to happen to me, and she would be left on her own. I think that was the real reason she didn't want me to marry Joy, because I would leave her. She was suffocating me, and that's how things went wrong between us. I might as well admit it. I ended up hating her. He lifted his glass and took a few sips of his beer. You didn't hate her, Joy said quietly. Things weren't right between you, that's all. You were both living in the shadow of what had happened, and you didn't realize how much it was hurting you.
You threatened her just before she died, Inspector Chubb remarked. He had already finished his own beer.
I never did that, sir. I never did.
We will come to that all in good time, Punt said. You did, in the end, leave Pye Hall. Tell us first about your time in Bristol.
It didn't last long. Now Robert sounded sullen. Sir Magnus had arranged it for me. After my dad left, he sort of took over and tried to help as best he could. He wasn't a bad man. Well, not all bad, anyways. He got me an apprenticeship with Ford Motor Cars, but it all went wrong. I'll admit I made a right mess of it. I wasn't happy on my own in a strange city. I drank too much, and I got into a fight at the local pub, the Blue Boar. It was all about nothing. He nodded at Chubb. But you're right. I did spend a night in jail, and there might have been worse trouble for me if Sir Magnus hadn't stepped in once again. He spoke to the police, and they agreed to let me off with a caution, but that was the end of it for me. I came back to Saxby, and he set me up with the job I have now. I've always liked tinkering with cars. I suppose I got that from my dad, although it's all he ever gave me.
What was it that made you argue with your mother in the week of her death? Punt asked.
It was nothing. She wanted me to mend a broken light, that's all. You really think I killed her because of that, Mr. Pound? I swear to you, I didn't go near her, and I couldn't have. Joy told you I was with her that evening and all night. We left the flat together, so if I'm lying, she's lying. And why would she do that?
You will forgive me, but that is not necessarily the case.
Punt turned to Joy Sanderling, who seemed almost to brace herself for what was to come. When you visited me in London, you told me you were together all the time. But are you certain that you were constantly in each other's sight? Did you not take a shower or a bath? Did you not prepare the breakfast?
Joy flushed.
I did both, Mr. Punt. Maybe they were 10 or 15 minutes when I didn't see Robert.
And your motor scooter was parked outside the flat, Miss Sanderling. Although it was too far by foot, it would have taken Robert no more than 2 or 3 minutes to reach Pye Hall, by your own admission. It is not impossible that he could have driven there, killed the mother who had caused him so much torment, and who stood so resolutely opposed to your marriage, and returned, all in the time that you were in the kitchen or in the bath. He let the proposition hang in the air, then turned again to Robert.
And what of Sir Magnus? He continued. Can you tell me where you were at 8:30 on the evening of his death?
Robert slumped, defeated. I can't help you there. I was in my flat, having supper on my own. Where else would I have been? But if you think I killed Sir Magnus, maybe you can tell me why. He never did anything to hurt me.
Your mother died at Pye Hall. He did not care enough even to attend her funeral.
How can you be so cruel? Joy exclaimed. You're spinning fantasies out of thin air just to accuse Robert. He had no reason to kill either of them. As for the motor scooter, I never heard it leave. I'm sure I would have, even if I was in the bath.
Have you finished? Robert asked. He got to his feet, leaving the rest of his beer untouched.
I have no further questions, Punt said.
Then if you don't mind, I'm going home.
I'm coming with you, Joy said.
Chubb glanced at Punt, as if to be sure that there was nothing more he wanted to ask.
Punt nodded very slightly, and the two young people left together.
Do you really think he might have killed his mother? Fraser asked, as soon as they were gone.
I think it is unlikely, James. To hear him speak of his mother just now, he spoke with anger, with vexation, and even perhaps with fear. But there was no hatred. Nor do I believe that he drove to Pye Hall on the motor scooter of his fiancée, even though it was interesting to suggest the idea.
And why? Because of its color. Do you not remember? It is something that I remarked to you when Miss Sanderling first visited us.
A man wishing to pass quickly through a village to commit a crime might borrow a motor scooter, but not, I think, one that was bright pink. It would be too easily noticed. Could he have had a motive to kill Sir Magnus Pye? It is possible, but I will admit that at the moment it is not making itself known.
All a bit of a waste of time, then, Chubb concluded.
He glanced at his empty glass. Still, the Queen's Arms serves a decent pint, and I have something for you, Herr Punt.
He reached down and produced Mary Blakiston's diary. Briefly, he explained how it had been found.
It's got something about pretty much everyone in the village, he said. Talk about dishing out the dirt. She's been collecting it by the bucket.
You don't suppose she was using the information to blackmail people? Fraser suggested. After all, that might give someone a very good reason to push her down the stairs.
You've got a good point there, Chubb said. Some of the entries are a bit vague. She was careful about what she wrote. But if people found out how much she knew about them, she could have had a lot of enemies, just like Sir Magnus and Dingle Dell. That's the trouble with this case, too many suspects. But the question is, was it the same person who killed them both? The detective inspector got to his feet.
"You'll let me have that back in due course, Herr Punt," he said. "I've got to get home. Mrs. Chubb is cooking her fricassee de poulet à l'ancienne."